Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly booze cast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
All right. Well, we're in this new year, 2020.
2020. You know what happened 100 years ago?
I do. It sucked.
We're talking about Prohibition again.
Yep. This was January, what did you say, January 17th?
Yes, that's when the Volstead Act went into effect.
All right.
So if it were 100 years ago, Prohibition would have just started this week.
I think we'd still be processing. I think we'd still be in denial, maybe.
Maybe. You know, you wouldn't really be affected by this because you're doing Dry January, so.
That's true. I'd be okay. You know, this is fine. I've had an easy time this January. I don't know if it was, you know, staring down a forever thing. Although I will say, we Americans kind of had a lot of years to prepare to adjust the threat of Prohibition, actually.
Oh, yeah. We can get right into it, right?
You know, we've had the idea of temperance in America pretty much as early as we've had, like, wildly available spirits.
Mm.
Really, like, late 1700s, early 1800s is the first time you kind of get, like, the temperance trend going. And this is kind of happening side by side with, like, you know, where we're having more available potable water. We're also having more widely available higher grade spirits. You know, back in the day, like we've talked about a million times, people would drink booze all day because it was safe to drink.
It was really low alcohol.
Yeah. Like now that you have like whiskey and gin at your disposal, you drink that all day, you're going to be
dead.
Yes. So, you know, like these early temperance efforts, they were a bit more, I would say, like genuine. They were backed by the church, by doctors, who, you know, we were just starting to understand the adverse health effects that alcohol could have.
Okay, so half of the doctors are saying that booze is bad for you, and the other half are saying booze is medicine, here you go.
Well, they just want you to have the right amount of booze.
Oh, okay.
You know, they're not saying all right. No booze. They're just saying, like, hey, maybe we should, like, not promote endless booze. Maybe we need to figure this out.
I'll write you a prescription for how much booze you should have.
But this late 1700s temperance movement made a little headway. Actually, this is where some of our Sunday laws or blue laws date back to, which is just, you know, no alcohol sales on Sunday. Mm. Some dry townships are established during this time period. But this momentum quickly gets squashed by what then directly precedes this, which is the Civil War.
Oh, yeah. You gotta drink through the Civil War.
And, you know, a great way to raise money for your side is to sell alcohol and profit off the sales of alcohol.
Right, yeah.
So we just put all that silly temperance discussion aside, and both the North and the South financed a large part of their wars through alcohol sales.
Mm, I bet the South was with bourbon.
Probably.
Because they like it.
They were making it.
They made a lot of it.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, after we get the Civil War out of the way, we enter the Reconstruction period. We have another resurgence of the temperance movement. And, you know, kind of this is actually goes back to, I know when we talked about Prohibition before, you talked about how there were a lot of women's issues that surrounded this.
Yeah, like, you know, my husband gets drunk and beats me up. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I'd rather have some rights, please.
Well, and, you know, when we were talking about this, I had a moment of, I think, naivete where I was like, that's really cool that, like, we powered this movement by, like, women. And, like, this is the 1800s, and these women were like, hey, this is a problem for me. It makes my quality of life worse. And that drove a movement. That was, in fact, naive.
Really? Oh, no. What was the real truth?
Well, I mean, no. Part of that is true. One of the first organizations that pops up here that becomes of extreme importance is the NWCTU, or the National Woman's Christian Temperance Union. And the stuff that they wanted and they fought for and would eventually grow to influence lobbies for was really good stuff. They wanted to raise the age of consent for women.
Great. I'm all for it.
Yeah. They wanted better custody rights for women and domestic abuses for their children. They were fighting for suffrage, the right to vote. So these, you know, had a lot of good, positive mission statements. And even when it came to alcohol, they started off, they wanted people to be educated about the dangers of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And they formed this Department of Scientific Temperance Instruction, which was supposed to kind of do just that. They just sort of picked the wrong person to head this up.
Oh, no.
There's a lady by the name of Mary Hunt who was chosen to run this. And she didn't care much for science, but she was good with politics. Because, like, her opinions on drinking, it's kind of like, it was like, abstinence is the only answer in her mind. Like,
okay.
Yeah, alcohol is, it turns to poison. It's made of poison. It will poison you. It's all poison. So just all scare tactics. Like,
right.
She like, was quoted as saying that she wanted to, like, create a youth composed of trained haters of alcohol.
A trained youth hater movement doesn't sound too good.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty bad.
You know, it's a, maybe not. Like, the mindset there already a little sketch. And, like, she was good, though, with, like, she would organize these giant lobbies that would pressure politicians into taking up, like, a dry platform or a temperance platform. And she would even, like then in turn, like, put pressure on, like, the textbooks that schools would buy, that if they didn't teach absolute abstinence from alcohol as, like, a core tenet, then those books wouldn't get sold.
Oh.
So she accrued a lot of interest.
She sounds like she makes, like, oatmeal cake or something. I want to know the disgusting thing she's bringing to the bake sale.
She does sound like absolute no fun.
There's lots of raisins in her stuff.
Well, and I mean, it doesn't stop there with her, because the other thing that's going on during this time, we're, like, you know, 1880s saw a massive rise in immigrants entering America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had millions of immigrants, and these were mainly from, they were largely, like, Eastern and Southern Europeans, and they, you know, they were bringing their culture, they were bringing their traditions and their religions with them. So, mm-hmm. you know, you had a lot of Catholics, a lot of Jewish people entering America, and they were largely settling in urban areas. Most of, like, the rural areas were still populated by, you know, the quote-unquote established families.
Right.
Who had more Protestant leanings.
Uh-huh.
Mary Hunt was deeply anti-immigrant.
Oh, so she hated science, but she also hated immigrants.
Yes. She wanted everything to stay the same. She wanted us all to eat, like, you know, saltless crackers and
dry toast.
Yes. So she used her position in power to sort of conflate the increase of immigrants with the increase of alcoholism. And, like, this sort of set the stage for this, like, temperance and anti-immigration platform that would sort of continue to be advanced on into the third wave of temperance that ultimately resulted in our prohibition.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So that kind of comes to head with the Anti-Saloon League. It's largely a Protestant lobby that was founded in 1893, started to kind of outpace the WCTU as the prominent anti-alcohol lobby. There was also not a small part of it that was because the WCTU was largely a women's organization, and the Anti-Saloon League was founded by men, and a lot of these women that kind of got swept up in this, like, let's keep America pure and good.
Oh, no.
Also defaulted their power, like, and men should be in control. Here you go.
Oh, no. This is bad.
Yeah. Well, and once again, like, on the surface, the goals of the Anti-Saloon League were good. They wanted people to drink less. They, you know, were fighting against alcoholism. But underneath that, they embraced all sort of nativist ideologues. They buddied up to the KKK, which took root as just a racist organization in, like, after the Civil War, but then they got to expand their portfolio of shit they hate and really get kind of, like, nationwide recruitment, because now, you know, they could hate Jewish people and Catholic people and immigrants and whoever they, you know,
hate everybody.
Yeah. So, you know, whether the temperance movement and the subsequent prohibition were really just a moralist mask for xenophobic hatred.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's arguable. There was definitely some of that there. I'm sure some people were just like, I don't like alcohol. And then a whole bunch of people took that and said,
oh, I don't like immigrants.
Yeah, we're going to hide behind this.
Yeah. Oh, no.
And either way, the roots of prohibition definitely have as much to do with the cultural bias and religious persecution as they do with the just people drinking too much. Speaking of religious groups, persecution.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so there were religious exemptions as part of prohibition. To go into that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the actual document. So we kind of use the 18th Amendment and like prohibition and Volstead Act like kind of interchangeably, but really the 18th Amendment is pretty vague. It's only 111 words. It's like three sentences, you know, it's like, don't drink intoxicating liquor. It's bad.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Okay.
Those are the three. No, that's not what it says, but you know what I mean? It was pretty vague. It prohibited intoxicating liquors, but it didn't say what that was. So the Volstead Act is the document that actually served to define what was prohibited and how they were going to enforce it. So this guy, David Blair, I'm sure we'll talk about him at some point. He was the Commissioner of Internal Revenue from 1921 to 1929, and he was responsible for creating the religious exemptions because the Volstead Act, as detailed as it was in the beginning, it didn't include that. So Title II of the Volstead Act is what we're going to talk about. That has the amendments that concern religious exemption. So Section 3 provided that wine for sacramental purposes may be manufactured, purchased, sold, bartered, transported, imported, exported, delivered, furnished, and possessed, but only as herein provided. And it was pretty vague. From what I read, it was mostly directed towards Christians using sacramental wine. And I mean, that's more specifically Roman Catholics.
Right.
So they just wanted to make sure that that was understood, that like Roman Catholics want to use sacramental wine, they can do that. So then later, Section 6 was added, and it was a lot more detailed, a lot clearer. It talked about how that was going to be accomplished. You need permits. And it not only talked about who could manufacture sacramental wine, but also who and what religions were aimed to benefit from the exemption. So that included Judaism, liturgical and evangelical Protestantism, Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and Episcopalianism. So there's more religions that use sacramental wine. So Section 6 actually named these other people, and then that was it was more clear. Because I feel like up until then, like, people were kind of still doing it, like kind of like turning a blind eye, but like it wasn't specifically, this was when the text in the document was actually aimed at people to know, like, no, yeah, like, we know you're going to use sacramental wine, like, you can do it, but here's how we want you to do it. Speaking of that, what were those Catholics doing?
Well, so those Catholics...
what were those Catholics up to?
No, you know, throughout these, like, kind of the development of the temperance movement that led to prohibition, there were some sects of Catholics that were kind of down with prohibition and with temperance. There were like small groups that formed, but by and large the church as a whole was anti-prohibition. You know, the leaders would not take a stance against alcohol. They kind of use the scapegoat as like, it's a political thing and that's not what we do. We're the church,
right? And, oh yeah. Church doesn't get involved in politics ever.
Yeah,
ever. Okay, let's move on. Okay,
I mean, it's worth stating there were some prominent Catholics that were in the Anti-Saloon League actually, but by and large, you know, like, once again, like, a lot of these Catholic immigrants, it was part of their culture from where they came from. The separation of alcohol and the church was just not something that made sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in the Code of Canon Law of the Catholic Church, uncorrupted grape wine has to be used during Holy Communion.
It's written down.
It's part of the practice, yeah. And even further, Catholics would argue that during the act of communion, they're not actually consuming wine.
Right. No, it's Jesus.
It's the blood of Christ. Right. So you can't charge me with, you know, consuming alcohol or procuring alcohol, because in the act of it is transformed. Which is a big separation of like Catholic belief and like you know, Protestants, which it's a symbol.
Right.
And as you said, like, during the first few years of Prohibition, there were definitely people turning a blind eye. Like, sacramental wine kept being used. But it was when they passed that little, you know, exemption that a lot of winemakers specifically took that as their loophole that they were going to use.
All right, we got the green light. We're going to do it. We're going to make sacramental wine.
A lot of the wine that had been made in sort of middle America, definitely more of these rural areas, that generally, like, those places went out of business, or they swapped to producing other things, to growing other things. The biggest foothold for the sacramental wine industry took place in California. Once again, it was a young population. It was immigrant population. So they were the ones that kind of took the loophole to the full effect. It wasn't particularly easy to get an permit to produce sacramental wine. You had to go through a few steps. First, you had to get the permit from the Prohibition Board. And to do that, you had, you know, you couldn't have anyone consume wine at your actual winery. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, you had to have a religious leader act as your proprietor and oversee all the distribution of your wine.
Oh, so you had to have a priest on site.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, with that guy there, I mean, I'm sure if he throws a wet blanket on him, nothing's going to get past him.
You know, you would think that would keep things on the up and up. But actually, wine production increased 700% during this time at these wineries.
Oh.
Yeah.
They're having more. Did they add more services?
Well, you know, a lot more people, I guess, were going to church.
I guess so. You know, I mean, it couldn't be. Like, in the Catholic Church, the laity, as they call it, the people who are not Catholic are not allowed to take part in the sacraments. So, right. You know, that's all sacramental wine. It's got to be used for that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and if you couldn't have, I guess if you didn't get enough of your Jesus at church, your priest could make a home delivery.
You could take Jesus to go. Yeah,
you know, he would bring some to your house, so you could have some for your house. Maybe you just happened to be throwing a party that day. Don't worry about that. Your priest is just bringing you for a religious service that you might have at your
house. Well, he's also a fun guy to have at your house for a party.
I mean, sounds at the time they were pretty fun guys. I mean, because, you know, at this, what we're saying is basically a lot of priests became bootleggers.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Yeah,
they
were selling wine. They were making deals. There's a great story that comes to us from William Faulkner, who recounted a meeting of his priest in New Orleans in, like, the church belfry, where he would, like, take the orders for the week from his wine customers. Just sounds like a cool scene for a movie or something, cool. Right? And of course it's New Orleans.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, and for that reason, the movie's not about that. That's just like a footnote in this, like, crazy New Orleans Prohibition time setting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's got to write that.
I know, right? That sounds great.
Yeah, that sounds good.
There was another prominent winemaker at the time, a guy by the name of Jorge del Toro, who was operating in Napa Valley, and he was good friends with an archbishop who promoted his wine for religious uses. So he kind of gave him the hookup into all these churches. Now, he sold a ton of wine, which you could say, well, he just was selling it to a lot of churches. But I do think it's worth noting that at this time, he was selling 14 different varietals of wine. So do you want some Cabernet for your Jesus blood? Perhaps a nice Riesling, maybe some Pinot Grigio. Is it a summer service?
Oh my God.
Are you serving it alongside fish? Like,
yeah, I mean, the fish is, I won't go there. I won't make that joke. Yeah, wow, bootleggers. I mean, that's just math. That's just, I don't know math, but that's math.
Well, yeah, you had some like 800,000 barrel increase in, like, wine sales from these places over the course of, like, the first two years of Prohibition, where this was legal. So definitely that's where it was going. And it was dangerous, you know, because now people understood there was a link between Catholic churches and having some booze.
Ah.
There was, like, a funny article in the Associated Press during this time period of, like, a guy coming into church, and the priest noted that he wasn't one of his usual followers, but, you know, he took part in prayer, and it was sort of like waited till everyone was, like, deep in a moment of prayer, and, like, you know, next thing you know, the guy's gone, and so is six quarts of communion wine.
Hey. That guy's devout. He's got to bring all that Jesus home.
Yeah, he didn't get enough from the service. He needed a little extra Jesus sometimes.
Some people need a little extra Jesus.
There was some story about, like, somebody who'd built a siphon into the basement of, like, a church storage. He sounds like something from, like, a Looney Tune. Like,
Shit, what's that coyote's name?
Wiley the Coyote.
The Roadrunner sketch. Yes. Wiley.
Oh, I have to wonder, like, did this person really, like, dig a tunnel? Or was this something, like, an agreement between the church and some, like, secondary location?
Yeah. They had to know about it. Like, and then when they found out, when the authorities found out, they go, where did this come from?
There's a pipeline in my basement.
How did this get here?
They built it in there when I was asleep. I don't know. But this was serious. Like, there were, like, shootings over, like, people, you know, actual robberies, like heists on church wine.
Wine heists?
There were wine heists. So, obviously, this was a huge reason that a lot of these wineries expanded, stayed in business, you know, made their money. This isn't really on topic that we're talking about, but there are two little footnotes that sort of go along with this that I enjoy.
Okay.
And that's just two of the other things that these wineries would produce to also help stay in business. One of those were wine bricks.
Okay.
Which were, you know, there was just basically a concentrated, like, brick of grape juice that you put in water, it dissolved, you could drink grape juice.
Nice.
But it did come with very specific, like, warning on the side. Do not leave the juice in a cool cabinet for 21 days or else you will make wine. And you can't do that because that's illegal.
Oh, yeah. You certainly wouldn't want to do that.
This is exactly how not to do the thing that you definitely don't
want
to do.
You definitely don't. Who wants that? You don't want that wine.
Wink, wink. Same, they sold wine tonics, which they said were medicinal in use. They're like 22% alcohol. And likewise, had a label on it that made a warning, like, this is medicinal. Do not serve over ice and consume, as then you will be consuming a beverage.
Don't enjoy it.
Yes, do not serve chilled, because then you'll be boozing. Yeah.
Good advice.
So the priests and the Catholic Church were finding a way to stay sauce throughout Prohibition. What was going on with
they weren't the only ones.
Oh, all right, there you go.
No. So actually, thanks to the language that they used in Section 6 that expanded to other religions, not just the Catholic Church. Under Section 6, a Jewish household was allowed a certain amount of wine per adult per year, for which you had to have a certification from your rabbi, much like the manufacturers that made the sacramental wine for the priests had to get a permit. So congregations during this time, it's estimated from 1920 to 1921, increased by a factor of 10, like going from 80 families to 900 families, for example. That's...
So that's a lot of devout people suddenly.
Yeah, you might think that. So when we talk about rabbis taking advantage of Section 6, there are two very different things to talk about. There were legitimate rabbis that were partaking in this and in some cases taking advantage of it. And there were also bogus rabbis.
But bogus rabbis.
Yeah. The first one, I'm going to talk about the legit rabbis first. So those rabbis who were actual, like, went through the rabbinate. I know you love that word
so much. I do like the word rabbinate.
It's a good word.
It sounds like a rabbit cabinet. Cabinet full of rabbits. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I shouldn't be making rabbit jokes. We're talking about...
We're actually talking about rabbis. Yes, okay. So they were legit rabbis who were legally buying sacramental wine and then illegally reselling it, which makes them...
Bootleggers,
yes. That is what... Yep. So most of the time, what they would do is they would exaggerate the amount of people in their congregation. So just like the example we just gave, you know, you had maybe... Your congregation didn't actually grow. Maybe you had 80 families, but you said you had 900 families.
All right.
So you would get the sacramental wine, which is like if you have like a gallon per year per adult and you have like a big family, which that kind of like during this time would be pretty commonplace, then you might have like 10 gallons of wine per family. So then you have like
9,000 gallons of wine. Nice. So you get that, and then you'd give what you actually, like, what the families actually need to them, and then you would sell the rest of it. There was a guy, rabbi, he wasn't just a guy, he was a rabbi. Okay. There was a rabbi named Henry Carr, got written up in the paper for his arrest. They confiscated 2 truckloads of wine from his home, and then also seized an additional 20 barrels from his storehouse down the road.
Wow.
I mean, just
truckloads.
Imagine a truck, and then imagine another truck.
And they're both full of wine.
They're both full of wine.
You know, right in the middle of dry January, I imagine that quite vividly.
Yeah. So there was so much division within the Jewish community, actually, about, like, whether or not we approve of this. There was a rise in Reform Judaism opposed to Orthodox Judaism, and many among the Reform Jewish leaders wanted to get rid of religious exemptions altogether and just switch to grape juice. That's how fed up they were with the Orthodox rabbis taking advantage of this. So, and it's worth noting that in California, which is where a lot of this took place, just like the, I mean, you know, that's where the wine's being made.
Yeah.
Most of the Orthodox rabbis were Eastern European immigrants who lived on really slim salaries. So they were actually using the wine sales to supplement their income. And so among the Reform rabbis' complaints were that the Orthodox rabbis gave permits to, like, gave the permits to actual, like, members of their congregation, and they were given a dollar for each permit, with the understanding that they would receive a commission for the wine sold. So the Reform rabbis are saying, well, they're just getting people to join just to get a permit. Mm. They're not really people of faith.
They were just trying to stay afloat.
Well, yeah, there's actually a really good example of that. Rabbi B.M. Paper of Beth Abraham in Oakland was one of these immigrant rabbis who took advantage of the religious exemptions, but he only kept a portion of the profit, and the rest went back to the congregation. So they were actually using the sacramental wine business to keep the congregation afloat.
Right.
Yeah. So this is like a, it's one of those cases of just like immigrants just trying to survive and doing the best they can, you know? Yeah. And there was a little bit of, from what I read, there was a little bit of xenophobia even like among the Jewish community, because when Prohibition happened, like, regardless of what the Jewish community thought about, like, Prohibition in general, they kind of saw it as an opportunity to vamp up their image of, like, being law-abiding citizens.
Mm.
So they saw these rabbis that were taking advantage of the system and doing something that's pretty, like, it was illegal. You weren't supposed to sell sacramental wine. Even if you procured sacramental wine legally, you couldn't sell it to anyone who was not part of these religious exemptions.
Right.
And they were obviously, they had to be selling it to non-Jews.
Right.
So along with growing congregations, I'm putting those in quotations, along with growing congregations.
Ah, yes.
Yes. The number of rabbis also increased in a way.
Hmm. Suddenly everybody wants to be a rabbi.
Right. I mean, it pays to be in the rabbinate.
Didn't say anything.
Okay.
I just thought.
So unlike the Catholic Church, where there's a lot going on as far as, like, keeping up appearances that goes beyond the general costume of being a priest, when it comes to, if, like, yeah, if you wanted to impersonate a priest, say, it would be kind of hard because you, like, maybe you can get the costume, but then, like, you know, if I'm like, I'm a priest, they're like, oh, well, what church do you preach at? And I grew up Catholic, and I know that that's not a right way to say that.
Well, it's a lot more controlled and documented. You kind of have to be accepted by the church, and the church recognizes you.
Right. I mean, you have to be like, oh, yeah, you know him? Like, no, we don't know that guy.
Yeah.
He's not a priest. But a rabbi doesn't necessarily need all that. There's not that much that formally distinguishes a rabbi from a lay person.
Mm.
So, like, who's to say that you're not a rabbi? Who's to say I'm not a rabbi?
Yeah. Maybe we're both rabbis.
Maybe we're rabbis, you know? So that's basically what was going on. Also, unlike the Catholic Church, a lot of the Jewish rituals take place in the home. And for this reason, rabbis were allowed under the Volstead Act to distribute sacramental wine throughout their congregation. So it wouldn't really seem suspicious should bootlegging be afoot.
Hmm.
And the American Jewish Committee was on to these abuses. There was a newspaper, The American Israelite, that put out an article. And a little excerpt from that is, a dozen Jews or even non-Jews can get together and call themselves a Jewish congregation. They can proceed to elect one of themselves or anyone else, male or female, Jew or non-Jew, as their rabbi. And there is absolutely no authoritative central Jewish body that can dictate to the pseudo-congregation what qualifications its rabbi must possess or even interfere in any way with its management. So, and the Jewish community was less concerned with people evading the law and much more concerned with people making fake congregations. In the same article, the author of this article calls prohibition a farce. So, you know, they weren't really, it wasn't really about, like, people getting away with it. It was like, you're making us look bad. Yeah. And, like, also, like, and you're not... Like, it's, I mean, it's insulting, you know. It's
disrespecting the faith.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, and it's true because, like, the, some of the stuff I came across was, like, yeah, there were rabbis with last names like Kelly. Like, there were Irish rabbis. There were black rabbis. But, like, and which, you know, today, like, you couldn't really say that that would, like, disqualify anybody. But back then, it was very much, like... Like, Judaism is a religion, but right. But most of the people who were practicing in the 1920s were also ethnically Jewish. So it's like, it was just way, way less commonplace back then for anyone who wasn't born in the Jewish religion to convert to Judaism.
Right.
So, and they obviously weren't really converting. They were just doing it to get the religious exemption. So as a result of that, there were tighter restrictions from the government, but that actually just did a lot more to inconvenience the legitimate practitioners rather than to deter bootleggers. So I also found this article from the Daily Bulletin, October 6, 1926, called Great Sacramental Wine Scandal in New York Charged by Prohibition Office. So according to this article, 600 rabbis were investigated, and... What was weird was that, like, I read the names, like, they listed, like, maybe, like, 10 names of some of the rabbis that were being investigated. And what's weird is that they were really only, from what I can tell, like, they were all very Jewish names. So they were really only targeting legit rabbis for, say, exaggerating the size of their congregation, which was happening. Like, there, in one case named in this article, there was a congregation that claimed 1,900 members, when it was closer to 300. But I'm just saying, like I couldn't find anything about a crackdown on the fake rabbis.
Well, so you mean to say it's almost as if they weren't concerned as much with police seeing the alcohol and more so as finding an excuse to prosecute people that they discriminated against?
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay, all right.
You sure could say that. Yeah, because, like, it didn't really stop bootlegging from happening. It was still happening. It was just, like, they basically went after the people that they could.
Right.
And then the people who were really just, like, not only are they're taking advantage of an exemption that doesn't apply to them. Like, the bogus rabbis were still getting away with it. So, you know, yeah, weird.
I mean... It kind of goes to serve the argument that maybe there was a lot more in Prohibition that had to do with nativism and xenophobia, yeah, than it had to do with actual concerns for people's health related to drinking.
Absolutely. The more and more we get into Prohibition, the more I am seeing that that is a big, that's probably it. That's probably it, the reason.
Yeah. I mean, and we still see that today where politicians hijack moralistic concerns to attached to their far more racist or xenophobic or, you know, greedy ideas. And they put a moralistic front on it, and then everybody gets behind it.
Yeah. Damn. 100 years, and here we are. 100 years later.
One of the things that, like, when I was researching the temperance movement, you know, there were they were facts generated by like the Anti-Saloon League to show that, like, you know, like 3 out of every 4 crimes that are alcohol fueled are committed by immigrants, and that's just completely made up. It's just a made up fact.
It's just yeah. nothing to that.
Fake news.
fake news. Real fake news.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, well, I hope given you something to think about when we're I was about to say celebrating 100 years since the start of Prohibition, but I don't know if we're celebrating it. We're not celebrating.
We're recognizing it. We celebrated Repeal Day. We're recognizing this.
Oh, yeah. No.
Well, okay. It is hard because, as we've said a million times, like, Prohibition has a lot of important effects on culture and society. I mean,
oh my God, yeah.
It helps drive modernity in a big way, you know, with a lot of different people drinking together in these speakeasies. So they didn't get what they wanted. In a way, it caused a bigger, like, widespread acceptance of other cultures, but I don't know, it's a complicated event in American history,
right?
It's fascinating.
I mean, I feel like that's it's so easy to draw a parallel to today, where, like, it's so divided in some ways, and then there's people who are, like, reacting to that division by being more inclusive and being together. Yeah. Wow.
That's true.
Wow.
Just history repeating. Welcome back to the Roaring Twenties. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I want to say thank you.
All right. You say thank you.
I want to say thank you to all of you guys listening. And thank you to everyone who donated to our Patreon. And thanks to all our new Patreon members. We are working on some new stuff for you on there. So go check it out. We're going to put that link in our show notes. And feel free to, if you do decide to support us, we're asking our supporters on Patreon to send us a booze-related question. We'll get to it. I promise. But we're also going to have some more rewards coming soon for you. So look out for that. Thank you to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show since the new year. It really helps us get the word out. So we really, really appreciate you guys. I'm going to read some names. Here they are. Tommy Smurl, Purple Worm, Akiye Kutsunai, Sarah Dykeman, Michael Beck. I heard you paint outhouses. That's somebody's Twitter name.
Well, you're just making a comment.
Okay.
Who told you that?
Chris Mim, Sydney McElroy, Dorothy Hoover, Jennifer, Karen B, Sierra, Alice, Joseph Shudmatse, Maya Lima Bean, Lainey, Frozen Nonbinary, Bison of the Year, Justin Hoops McElroy, Sunny, Rachel McElroy, Deanne, Mike Tupapun, Mia Smash, Mary Smurl, Austin Wills, Pete Rattleclaw Recluse, Elliot Taylor, Kaylee, Zeewee, and Joshua Lively. Thank you so much for tweeting and retweeting. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe and give us a review if you like. Thanks. And don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel tomorrow. We're going to have some cocktails that pertain to this episode.
They're going to be sacrilegious.
Ooh, was that a play on sacrilegious and delicious?
It was, yes. Thank you for clarifying that.
I'm sorry. I don't know why that's an impulse for me to explain.
Just always do that, please.
I'll stop, I promise.
What Taylor means is...
Oh, all right, I'll cut that out. We'll just say that.
No, I love it. It's funny.
Okay.
All right. I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Liz June.
And this has been Neat.